it's always really interesting as the retreat goes on and you get more peaceful and closer to enlightenment, you get more questions. Oh, dear me. Okay, here we go. Question number one. If you can get to deep states of meditation in other religions too, what is the main difference in Buddhist meditation? Because you did not explain. Was it anatta this morning? I'm a bit confused now. Can you explain it briefly, please? There's no one there. Anatta. Who do you think you really are? So just an accumulation of conditions. Nothing else left. So that's all there is, a big hole in the center of what you think you are, nothing. And this is actually I remember when I wrote something like this in that book, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, the editor said, oh, well, you see, you can get into these things in other religions, jhanas in other religions. I mean, what's the main difference? And really, this Buddhism got there first. And I know that some people really question this, but it says very clearly in the suttas, in the Panchalaka, is that Panchalaka Chanda? Was it Panchalaka Chanda Devaputta in the Sanyutta Nikaya, who sort of sang this verses of praise of the Buddha. And one of those lines is the Buddha who discovered jhanas. And that's also repeated. Every now and again you get sort of suttas which are found elsewhere in other parts of the Pali Canon, which shows you that it was one of the very early original suttas, because it was commented in the actual canon. Somebody asked Ananda, what did the Buddha mean by, or what did Panchalaka Ananda mean by that? It's repeated there. So they said the Buddha actually discovered these jhanas. And once the Buddha actually discovered these jhanas, because you need the middle way to get the jhanas first of all, and later on, sort of, obviously, that some of these teachings spread in many, many directions. And one of the reasons, I was mentioning this in the interviews, one of the reasons why in the mystical Christian traditions, which only usually happened in the monasteries, the very remote monasteries, not the monasteries which get involved in worldly things, but the remote monasteries of Christianity, that some of them would get into those jhanas because of their ability to surrender. They surrender to like a higher being, to a god. And that type of surrender is very, very close to what we mean by letting go. You have to disappear. Okay, for the Christian, it was a little bit easier because they had something to disappear into, to let go for some idea of a god. But because they let go, they surrendered, they disappeared, that they could get into some of those states. And it's exactly the same when you're meditating. Anyone here who's ever got into a deep meditation, you ask them, what did you do? And they always say, I let go. I did nothing. It just happened. Yeah, now that should actually make an impression on you. That's actually how you get into deep states. You surrender your will, your control, everything. Give up, renounce, chucking out, remember, Patinissika. And because that was a very strong thing in Christian monasticism, not everybody, just a tiny few, would get into those jhanas. But the difference was is their framework, how they would understand those experiences, you know, would be through their religion. So, whether it was in Hinduism, I remember this fellow who used to practice with, I think, Swami Muktananda, I was talking with him about the meditation they were doing over there, and that was actually one of the leading Hindu practitioners of meditation. And they were supposed to visualize, eventually get the nimitta. They called it the blue pearl nimitta, like a blue nimitta. And when I was talking with him, it was very interesting. They said that once you actually merge in that blue nimitta, and this is in the standard traditional Hindu tradition, that is enlightenment. That's union with Brahma. Then you've made it. And, you know, that was their goal, the ultimate. It was a samadhi experience. A samadhi being like a deep jhana experience. And that would be very similar to sometimes what you understand as someone who had, you know, they Christian tradition, they have this experience, and you come out afterwards, what the heck was that? And when you try and describe it to yourself, if you're a Christian, you say, wow, that's the ultimate, union with God, because that's what they call the ultimate. However, because that's your conceptual framework, that's as far as you'll go, and you'll never mine that experience for the data of, say, non-self. One of the wonderful things is, so, you know, that's just like a first jhana experience when you first merge with the nimitta. But then you get into a second jhana, a third jhana, and a fourth jhana. There's another levels beyond that. And as you get to more and more of these jhanas, you know, you start to, the penny starts to drop. You know, what exactly is happening there? You can actually see not just the difference between the jhana realm and the ordinary human consciousness, but each of the jhana realms. And the thing you notice from those experiences is what's missing, what's dropped away. And what's dropping away is the sense of self. Everything you've ever conceived of as being you is now not there anymore. And this is shocking at first, but the evidence is so strong. It's a personal experience which lasts for many hours, you repeat it many times, and you can't deny the evidence. In second jhana, there's no will. It's gone. And you go in deeper jhanas, there's parts of your knowing, your consciousness is fading away. Now, the knower, which is the last citadel of the idea of me. Okay, I might not be the one who does things, but I'm the one who knows. But deep inside over here, there's something listening. And it's always been listening. It's always been hearing. It's always been knowing. And that's the essential me. Now when that starts to disappear, that gets a bit spooky. Because everything you've ever held on to be a self, fundamentally, which you haven't even questioned because it's so obvious to you, is now challenged. And as you go through the jhana experiences, as you travel from one to the next, is just a dissolution of the knower. The knower starts to fade away. Until you get to what we call, you know, the last of the arupa states. And this is, you know, you read about this in the text, neither perception nor non-perception. And you haven't got a clue what that can mean. Something weird and strange. And it sounds very Zen-like, neither perception nor non-perception. What's actually happening there is the mind is disappearing. It's fading away. And just before it fades away, the last stay before it fades away. There's nothing left. But you perceive there's nothing left. That might sound a bit of a contradiction in terms, but that's how it is. The object is nothing there. But you know there's nothing there. And this is why you call it neither perception nor non-perception, depending on the angle you're describing it from. As far as the object is concerned, there's nothing there. That's no perception. As far as the subject, if you like, you're perceiving there's nothing left. And that's a temporary state. Because after a while, when you perceive there's nothing there to perceive, I mean absolutely nothing, not even a concept of nothing, then the mind can't stay. It stops. It disappears. And the knower has gone. Turns on up again later on. You haven't sort of disappeared forever. But you now had an experience of complete cessation. And you come back after that and you've got the evidence there. And the idea that there can, this thing which knows can be a permanent self, an entity, has gone. It's just a bunch of conditions. Just like I said this morning, the world is a bunch of conditions. Now that's what you read in the suttas. That's what the Buddha keeps on saying. And when you get that framework, and you get it from the, you know, the Aryas, enlightened ones as well, it means when you have those experiences of jhanas, that's how you'll investigate it. You'll look to see if those signs are there. And because you're looking in that direction, you'll see it. And because you see it, then you go further than just union with God. You just go to dissolution. Disappearing, enlightenment, gone forever. So this is actually just the difference here. The framework of the Dhamma is enough to take you much further. Which is why it says, as I said before, that, which is one of the great quotes, Nati janang apanyasa panya nati ajayato yam hi janang cha panya cha sawe nibbana santike. I've said that so many times, I can sort of do without thinking. Verse 372 of the Dhammapada. That really impresses people when they sort of, you know, say in Pali, I know which verse it is. That's why sometimes, especially going to places like Sri Lanka, because sometimes they think you're a forest monk. Okay, you can meditate, but you don't know sort of the Dharma like the professors do. So, you know, when you play the professor sometimes, it can really impress people. But anyhow, that's not why I say it. The reason I say it is because the meaning is just really gets to me every time. There is no jhana without wisdom. You need the insight to get the jhana. There is no insight without jhana. There's no jhana without insight. This is Mrs. Samatha and Mr. Vipassana always go together. And the third line is, but where you have jhana and insight, jhana and panya, or jhana and wisdom, if you like, you are in the presence of Nibbana. You're right next door. Now that's a great, great quote by the Buddha. What that means is, if you've got the jhana, but you've got no wisdom, no real framework, or the framework is not strong enough, you've got enough wisdom to get the jhana, but the wisdom is not strong enough, then it's like sort of the person who gets a union with God experience. They got the jhana, but they misinterpret it. But if you got all the wisdom, in other words, you've read all the books, and you're a Pali scholar, and you've got a PhD three times over, once in Buddha, once in Dhamma, once in Sangha, or whatever else it is, then you got the wisdom, but you got no experience. Again, it still doesn't work. But you've got the two together, and that's why I said it's like the map is like the wisdom. You've got the map. And you've got the flashlight is the jhana. And you can find where the treasure is. Or if it's the other similar idea, it's like the the wisdom is like the gunpowder. And the jhana is the match. And you put those two together, the match and the gunpowder, and it goes bang. So you destroy defilements that way, become enlightened. We need the two together. You've got gunpowder but no detonator, no match, it doesn't work. You've got a match and no gunpowder, you can't blow up anything with that. You've got the two together, and bang. So this is what we mean by the wisdom and the jhanas. You need both. Any questions on that? Yes.
When you said that the Buddha discovered jhanas, did you mean in this present time?
Yeah. When you say Buddha discovered jhanas, I never said that. That's in the suttas, quoted by Panchalaka, Chanda. Devaputta means like a god, one of the sort of the devas, and is repeated by Ananda. Oh no, who was it who asked? Somebody asked Ananda, I forget who was it who asked Ananda, what does that mean? So Ananda quoted it, it's well known, obviously, that particular verse. But what it really means to discover, those jhanas were in previous times, but the Buddha, if you like, rediscovered it. It was lost. So in other words, you know, you may lose your purse. And I discover it. It wasn't as if the purse didn't exist before, but you know, you didn't know where it was. And then I discovered it. So that's what it means to discover it. I mention that because so often people say, oh, the Buddha discovered Vipassana. Never says that at all, but it does. You can quote discovering jhanas. Dear Ajahn, I feel so sad. If meditators would just concentrate to meditate and go to the four holy states of the mind, they would not be affected by any noise, speech or action carried out by others. We are all here to... Oh, another one of these noise ones. We are all here to learn and listen to the Dhamma. Wouldn't it be beautiful just to be content and happy and not complain about others? You're complaining about somebody there. You're complaining about the people who complain. I saw through that one straight away. Thank you, Ajahn, for all your kindness, patience and compassion. Buttering me up doesn't work. We hope all of us will progress and be better persons after this treat. I agree, yeah. So... complaining about the person who complained yesterday. And let it all go. It's in the past. And just poor people. Just sometimes people make noises. That's just their nature. Some people make more noises than others. This is not a question. It is a true story written for your entertainment. Better than watching novices fall off benches. P.S. I also wrote it to give my dual mind a little treat. I've been told to get lost so often lately that I was feeling somewhat sad. When I said get lost, I mean get your ego lost. And I don't mean sort of, you know, being rude to you. Okay, here is a story. Are you sitting comfortably? Then I will begin. Here we go. Well, it's a bit long, but never mind. A teaspoon of wisdom, or the fault-finding mind, a cautionary tale for retreatants. Once upon a time, there was a teaspoon. It was an ordinary, plain, stainless steel teaspoon, empire-made and purchased by a newlywed from Boots the Chemist in Bromley, an old market town in southeast London. But this teaspoon had an extraordinary life, and although now lost forever, it once travelled around the world and stirred up a storm in the teacup of her mind. After a short spell of daily duty in an upstairs masonette kitchen, it was pocketed as a last-minute thought by the new, not-so-newlywed spouse, and travelled thus to Heathrow Airport to board a BA flight to Perth, Western Australia. Here it did sterling service in various suburban homes before taking to the skies again, this time to the nation's capital, Canberra, where it dutifully stirred a public servant's tea, after hours, of course. Returning to WA some years later, it eventually settled down in the same pale blue plastic cutlery tray where it had started its workaday life, but this time in the kitchen drawer of a cottage on the eastern edge of the Swan Valley. Who lives over there? Their time passed and the teaspoon was used, washed, dried and replaced many times. As its shiny surface began to show signs of wear and tear, so did its owner's marriage. Finally, it found itself in the safe care of its original purchaser. But no beverage, however, earnestly stirred by the said spoon was able to soothe the mind of its unhappy owner. Relief from suffering was sought in the practice of meditation. One cold June day, the teaspoon was packed with a few other items of tableware to accompany its owner to a weekend retreat. It was a bleak winter weekend. The teaspoon and others were accommodated in an unwelcoming cabin set among the eucalypts slowly succumbing to dieback disease. The rain beat down relentlessly from leaden skies as retreatants scurried beneath brollies from the meditation hall to the dining area for bowls of steaming soup and the ever-welcome cuppa stirred by the trusty teaspoon. Here disaster struck. One mealtime the teaspoon was left behind in the washing-up bowl and forever parted from its owner. How sad. This loss of an old friend and faithful servant was a cause of much grief. Forgetting the heedlessness which had led to the loss of the spoon, the ex-owner blamed all and sundry for its disappearance. The fault-finding mind was agitated by angry emotions and irrational thoughts. How could anyone go home with someone else's teaspoon? Don't people know how many teaspoons they started out with? Can't they count? Or if they can, where is the extra teaspoon left behind in error? Are they unable to distinguish their own cutlery from other people's? They must be blind. Weren't they supposed to be practicing mindfulness? Have they no respect for other people's property? So seethed the owner's mind all weekend, which was devoted to the practice of meta-meditation. As helpless tiny kittens were visualized to arouse feelings of loving-kindness, teaspoon thoughts swirled around the fault-finding mind of the bereaved owner. And for many years afterwards, the teaspoon lived on in memories tinged with irritation and despair. But slowly, slowly, the gentle warmth of loving kindness planted in that mind during a winter retreat long years ago is melting that frigid, fault-finding mental state. One day, that mind will run freely as a crystal clear stream, reflecting the truth. All teaspoons are impermanent, unreliable and impersonal. I say all things, even teaspoons. One day. It's gone. <Here's the rest. laughs> That's the end. I thought it had a happy ending. You know what I thought? I thought you came to another retreat, and you came to another retreat, and that sort of idiot who stole your teaspoon also came, and you refound your teaspoon, and you were united with its owner, and you lived happily ever after, stirring each other with happiness. Okay, it's true. It's amazing how people can get angry over a little teaspoon. Where's my teaspoon? Or where's, you know, my silence? It's just like possessiveness and attachment. Doesn't matter if you lose a teaspoon, there's many more there. Doesn't matter if you lose a husband, there's many more out there, or wife. Just like a teaspoon, that's all it is. So I leave it all there. Anyway, thank you very much for that, author. Dear Ajahn, my dreams have become very vivid during the retreat. I dream of very fine details of people's emotions, looks, etc. Should I sleep less or just let it go? Next time. See if you can dream of six numbers. No, don't do things like that. Your dreams have become very vivid during the retreat. I think sometimes it is because sometimes we're sleeping too much. Because when we get sort of calm and peace, we don't need to sleep so much. It's just nature, that's all. So a lot of times that, you know, we think, oh no, I should be sleeping more, simply because that's your usual habit, but you don't feel like sleeping, so you carry on, turn over, and then that's actually when you get the most vivid dreams. What's actually saying is your brain is ready to wake up, but you know, for some reason you think you should still be in bed. And you work with the body, and if it feels like it wants to get up, forget about the clock, just get up and meditate. If you make a mistake, you can always go back to bed again. And that's fine. So you can sleep at any time, so just work with the body, and then you don't get so many dreams. But if you want to stop your dreams, or get sort of nice dreams, just when you go to sleep at night, just present moment awareness and silence. And if you're really silent when you go to sleep, that silence sometimes stays with you, so you don't have any dreams. So that's a much nicer way. So you can sleep efficiently. But it doesn't matter if you have some really nice dreams. Sometimes, especially if they're like, you know, nice dreams of meditation or sort of jhanas, or so these are sort of what dreams, which monks dreams. I remember this one dream I had many, many years ago. It's a great dream. I was having a psychic battle with this Hindu guy. And it was a really great dream. It was flying through the air and sapping each other. We made a great movie. And because it was my dream, of course I wanted it. Because it's my dream. We just have a bit of fun and games. It's just like these limiters which come up of like visions and stuff. You can play around with them. So remember, because this is an interesting point as well, because when you get very, very still, sometimes you have the visions in your mind. These are not the very powerful, beautiful limiters of a single life, but sometimes you have visions in your mind. And if these come up, fine, you can play around. It's just almost like a dream, but you're awake. It's just the mind, perception is having a bit of fun and games. Oh, that's okay. So don't worry too much about, you know, dreams. As long as they're positive, nice dreams, you know, doing psychic battle with one of the monks or something, that's really fun. Any questions about that before we go? Okay, next one. Could you explain how you transfer merit to deceased relatives? I mean, are they trying to receive these? How can we do that? Whether they're trying to receive them or not, if you send them a letter, it gets put in their door. So whether they want the letter or not, doesn't really matter. So all you need to do is to, number one, you think of them, you visualize them, you remember them, that gets the connection going. And then you sort of, you have to have something to give first of all. So if you're upset and angry, I wouldn't start visualizing your relations. You're not sending them anything really positive. So if you really feel nice and peaceful and happy, having a really good time, you can actually send some loving kindness, and go and send some to them. This even works with live relations as well. I usually do this on every retreat. The last day of the retreat, we do a metta meditation. And I love doing this because it proves to people it works. Because sometimes we are skeptical, or rightly skeptical. You should be skeptical. But it's nice to actually do experiments to test out whether these things actually work or not. So the last day of the meditation retreat, when we do a metta meditation, towards the end, when you've really got lots of loving kindness going, it's really strong, I tell you to think of one particular person, someone reasonably close to you. And it's even better if they're a long way away. If they're over in Sydney or Singapore or Melbourne or a long way away. And then really think of them and really zap them with as much loving kindness, for over a minute or two, as much as you can. And when I do that, I usually open my eyes, look at my clock and note down the time. And after the meditation is finished, I tell you, look, that was the time you zapped them. Now, when you go home, ask them, what were you doing at that particular time on a Saturday afternoon? The 14th of April? It's amazing. You'd be so surprised. You don't ask leading questions. It's just, what were you doing? I say, funny you asked me that. I was thinking of you. I felt so really good. I felt depressed and suddenly I sort of felt good. It works. And what usually happens is Saturday evening, people ring me up, Ajahn Brahm, I just did that, and my husband felt it. It worked. So it's a great little experiment to do. Now, if you can do that with a living person, that's exactly what happens with a dead person. They're not that far away, you can contact them. How can you actually send, loving kindness from here to Singapore? Immediately. It doesn't make any sense, but it works. The same way you can do that with deceased relations, no matter where they are. Think of them. Visualize them and zap them. Unfortunately, you won't be able to give them a call to say, did you receive it or not? So that's the way to do it with real relations, first of all. And then you'll know that it's going to probably work with the deceased ones, too. So that's how it works. Very easy and good fun to do. As a layperson, were you able to attain any stage in the path to enlightenment or only up to stream winner? Please explain. No. You can't tell people about what you've got up to in your... sometimes I go a bit far and people get the message. But you're not supposed to tell any layperson about your jhanas, psychic powers, memories of past lives, enlightenment experience, or anything like that at all. That's one of the rules. It's the eighth Pajiti rule. And there's a reason for that. And this reason, I was reading a book by this monk, Chakun Dhamma Pitoka, I think, a Thai monk. And he said it so beautifully, why is that rule there? And it is a rule is there because, we're not supposed to have, a caste system in the Sangha. They had in India, they had the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas and this caste and that caste. It was like a social hierarchy. This caste was better than that caste, was better than some other caste. And the Buddha really rebelled against that. And so even in the Sangha, we all wear the same robes. Okay, so I, sit on the highest seat sometimes. But, a lot of times if you see us, out of the monastery, you don't know who's a senior and who's a junior. Now the hierarchy, is not all that apparent because the Buddha didn't want it to be apparent. A monk is a monk is a monk, a nun is a nun is a nun. So the hierarchy was supposed to be suppressed. Now can you imagine what happened if we all told exactly where we were on the path. Who was enlightened, who was fully enlightened, who was only half enlightened, who was just nowhere, who was just got the jhanas, who couldn't even just watch the breath for a moment. And if we all told you who was who, then what would happen? All the good monks, the elite monks, we'll invite you to our house for dana. We invite you to do the chanting. You can give the talk, but you are the riffraff, you hopeless, no hopers. We don't want you in our monastery. We're not wasting our dana on you guys, or you girls. You will have a two-tier sangha. The joke which I made, because the enlightened ones are called the Aryas. The Aryas. And so I said, if you let everyone know who is the Aryas, you will have the Aryastocracy. In Buddhism, and you don't want that because that is setting up this hierarchy business, and the top monks, and that happens sometimes in Thailand and other places, and they try and figure out who the really good monks are, who are the great monks, and if you're going to give any donation, you want to make sure you get your bang for bucks, as they say. You get the best karma from your donation. So you look around, see who is the, you know, who's the good monks. So if I'm going to give a donation, you know, from if you give sort of a plate of food to an arahant, you get much more good karma than if you sort of give a plate of rice to a scallywag monk. So because of that, and that's true, so that's why people want to find out, you know, who should I give dana to? And that happened to me when I was staying with Ajahn Chah, the old story that food was disgusting. I've told many stories about disgusting food, because it was a village food in the northeast. But every now and again you get people coming from town, and when they came from town, they gave food which I didn't like, but at least you could eat it. It was like, you know, something which was remotely edible. So one day a car came back, one of these pickup ute trucks, in the back, lots and lots of food, because there's maybe about 60 monks and maybe the same number of nuns in this monastery. So it's a big monastery, even in my first year I was there. And they came with all these pots of food. And I thought, as soon as I saw it pull in, I thought, great, I'm going to have something to eat today, a good meal. And I was a young monk, and food was important to me. You know, when you're 23, 24, you know, food is very important. And so I thought, great, can have a nice meal today. And the driver of the car simply got out, came into the dining hall and said, is Ajahn Chah here? And it was Ajahn Liam was number two monk, and he said, no, he's gone out to a house for dana. So the guy got back in the truck and drove off. No food for us. There's no way that he was going to waste his food on ordinary monks like us. If it wasn't for Ajahn Chah, it wasn't worth it. And that really hurt. I mean, it really hurt for young monk. So that's why we don't tell who's in line and who isn't. We keep it nice, and it also stops any ego trips for monks. Because sometimes you get that too. You know, people are like, I'm enlightened. How enlightened are you? I'm more enlightened than you are. Da 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 da. So stop all of that. But the only time you really find out is that somehow it's a tradition. It's on your deathbed. Just when you're about to die, that's when you're supposed to let people know what you've been doing all your life. So you've got to wait. Or sometimes when you're almost dead, sometimes give some sort of poison which looks like you're dying, but you know, then find out and then give the antidote afterwards. I don't know. Ready? Sorry? But no, cat's not dying. She. Anyway. Next question. Is there any questions on that one? It's a common question people ask about, you know, what you've been up to. Yeah?
Why is it that you can't imagine? I thought the fact that you're giving, whether it's to anyone, would be the same.
It's, no, it's like if you're going to be sort of planting, say, a veggie garden, some soils are much more productive than others. And if you're an arahat, the reason is you're giving energy to that arahat. And that arahat's going to really be able to teach. So you're allowing that arahat to make really great karma. So you're getting share of that karma, share of that action. So you can see the power of an arahat is much greater than the power of an anagami or stream winner or whatever. And so by you giving food, you're helping to spread dharma in the world. So that's always how it works. You know, that's the way things work. But the Buddha didn't want to emphasize that. That's why he always kept on saying the best dana is to the whole Sangha, of both sides, monks and nuns.
Does it make the same for bad people? Like if you help people that then go and
do bad karma? That's a great question. If you help someone who does bad karma, do you get much merit there? You don't get as much merit as if you help people do good karma. Because this is actually what the merit is. You're allowing goodness to grow in the world. It's solving suffering, lessening suffering. And the more effectively you can do that, the greater the karma. That's why, you know, it is, I know people sort of argue with me about this, it is much better karma to give a donation, say, to a retreat center where people are learning meditation than it is to a hospital. People say, nah, there's enough monks and churches and stuff, we need more hospitals. But you know what a hospital does? And it heals physical pain. But that's not as powerful as healing the mental pain of suffering once and for all. So So I don't just say that because, you know, we're building a retreat center, but this is just an example of how it works. And sometimes, you know, monks need to explain that. You know, why, you know, you give money to a nun's monastery? And what's that going to help? Great for the nuns, but what about us? Should we give it to an orphanage instead? No. Because, you know, the nun's monastery is people getting enlightened in that place. People actually learning to spread the Dharma, making it like it possible for people to live as nuns in the West in the future. It's huge good karma. And that's why the effect of that, you know, the bang for bucks is much better than for a hospital. Anyway, that's how I see it. Anyway, we've got, okay, we have a quote here from the suttas, Anguttara. I declare, monks, that actions willed, performed and accumulated will not become extinct as long as their results have not been experienced, be it in this life, in the next life, or in subsequent future lives. And as long as these results of actions willed, performed and accumulated have not been experienced, there will be no making an end of suffering, I declare. Ajahn, could you explain the full and correct meaning to the statement as made by the Blessed One? A lot of times, that if you read the suttas, it has to be read in the context. And I think here it is true in the case that you can't escape from the results of your karma, but you can dilute them. In other words, if you have a spoonful of salt and you put it in your cup of water, the whole thing is very salty. You can hardly drink it. But if you put a spoonful of water in a whole rain tank of water, and then you take some spoonful of salt in the whole rain tank of water, and you just drink that, you can hardly taste the salt because it's diluted. So this is one of the great teachings of the Buddha. You can dilute karma, both good and bad. In other words, if you've done some good karma, you've done lots of bad karma, you probably hardly taste the results of that good karma. They usually say the other way around, because we're always thinking about diluting our bad karma by making lots and lots of good karma. But it works both ways. But can you actually escape the results? In most cases, no, but you have the exception to this rule. And the exception to this rule is the Aryas, the enlightened ones. Because there is, elsewhere it says this, it's called ahosi karma. Ahosi karma, it means karma which should have ripened but cannot ripen anymore. And a great example of that is, say, Angulimala. So a serial killer, and that karma couldn't ripen fully because he became an enlightened one. And this is another fascinating part of the law of karma, that there are karmic results which lead to the hell realms. Do you believe in hell? Is there such a thing? And who sends you down there? When I was young, that was one part of Christianity you just couldn't accept. How could a compassionate, kind God create a hell and throw people down there for just a simple reason they didn't believe in him? That never made any sense to me. But then when I read about Buddhism, yeah, it's supposed to be hell realms down there. And how can that happen? And the answer is very clear once you learn a way how the mind works, and the classical descriptions of suttas say these are manomaya realms, mind-made realms. You create the hell. So it's not a place which is there, as it were, waiting for you, like some sort of prison. That the place you go, if you go to hell, you make it to suit yourself. It's self-designed and created. And why do people go down to hell? Because they think they deserve to. You send yourself down there, you create the punishments, and you stay down there as long as you think you deserve to. And that makes a lot of sense if you just know basic psychology. Why is it that people punish themselves and don't allow themselves happiness? I mentioned that earlier with that nun who would not allow herself to get into jhanas. That is not uncommon. And it goes deep in every human being who doesn't know how to forgive. But the core of forgiveness, what makes forgiveness very easy, as you knew, or you tasted this morning when I gave that talk about non-self, and you never chose to come here anyway. When you can see that truly, there's no self, no one in here, I'm not the doer, I'm not the knower, you call at least the stream winner. And stream winners cannot go down to hell. Why? Because they stop punishing themselves. There's no one to punish anymore. They see they're just a process. How can you punish a process? How can you judge a process? Which is why it is part of the technical Dharma of Buddhism. Once you become a stream winner, you cannot go down to the lower realms anymore. Karma has been stopped, which you have done, but you don't experience the fruits. In the Abhidharma they call that ahosi karma, karma which was and cannot come to fruition. And it's wonderful, it's amazing to see that that's why hell happens. You make it, you create it, you send yourself down there. That's the psychology, and it's a tough one to overcome. But when you do this meditation and you see non-self, you don't need to punish yourself anymore. It's very hard to forgive yourself. The more you see non-self, the easier it is to do. Another profound teaching of the Buddha. So anyway, that's my comment on that thing. Yes?
You seem to be thinking that
the arahants don't receive any faults of karma. Oh, no, I didn't say they don't. The arahants don't receive the totality of their bad karma they've made in the past. They receive some of it. And Gaudiya sort of, you know, he got beaten and things thrown at him from the other people. But, you know, it was just a fraction, almost hardly significant, of the sort of karma which he would have got if he hadn't got enlightened. Anyway, let's go to the next question. There's many questions to go. I think I collected unwholesome karma. Aha, by getting angry when I see monks preach something and don't entirely opposite of that. Okay, I think I can get unwholesome karma by getting angry when I see monks preach something and do entirely opposite of that. How can I change my attitude to such situations? I understand your question. When monks says one thing and they do something else. When they're hypocrites. Now the first thing to do is, before you get angry, to say, do I do the same? Am I a hypocrite? And then you look at yourself and say, yes. So why get angry at someone else who does the same as you do? They're on your side. They should be your friend. They're just the same as you. You can empathize with them. That's what should happen. But you can get disappointed. Yeah, because like a teacher or a preacher, they're supposed to be teaching not just with words, but by example as well. We all know that the example is even more important than the words. But the words are also important. But sometimes it's just the fact that somebody is actually trying to do their best, trying to teach. It's not an easy job to be a teacher of Dhamma, because such a sort of high standard sometimes. And so, you know, you just do get other monks, nuns, lay people, do their teaching sometimes. So don't be too hard on them, they're trying their best. And again, your job is, am I doing my best? Could I do better? That's why, instead of getting angry at them, just that's part of life. They're trying, they're doing whatever they can do. So don't get angry if they're doing something different. Your job is to make sure that you're not a hypocrite. Make sure that you're doing your best. Ajahn Chah always used to say, to stop this fault-finding mind, you should look at yourself. He told us as young monks, look at yourself at least 90% of the time, or 95% of the time, I think it was. Only look at others at most 5% of the time. So most of the time when we're fault-finding, we say, her fault, is his fault, is someone else's fault. We never look at ourselves. In fact, it's just a distraction from actually getting to see where the real problem is. So I don't need to get angry in any way. As I said, why allow the stupidity of somebody else to control your happiness and make you angry? So refuse to get angry no matter what someone says. or does. You can disapprove of it, you can argue with it, but don't get angry at it. Dear Ajahn, I noticed part of my motivation was coming from anxiety, wanting to understand so I could deal with and overcome a difficult world that I felt against. I stopped coming from this place and I now feel really more relaxed and happy, but I'm concerned about where my drive will now come from. Okay. Now you started off with what we call the hard drive from anger, and now you have the soft drive from loving kindness. And it is the soft drive from loving kindness that motivates you. Sometimes I used to wonder, you know, what motivates, say, an enlightened person to let go of all desire and all craving? And sometimes I thought, like an enlightened person, how they ever go to the toilet. They'll be standing here, they feel something in their bladder, and they're all thinking of no desire, no desire. Let go, let go. And they just wet their pants every time. So what motivates an enlightened person who's got no desire to go to the toilet? It's obviously metta, loving kindness, compassion. And if not for them, for other people. Now that's the drive which you will have. So it's not coming from trying to get something, but just how can I give, how can I serve, how can I make this world a happy place? And how can I be comfortable as well, metta towards oneself. So the drive, once you get rid of the negative drives, you know, from trying to attain something, get something for yourself, it comes a loving kindness, a compassion. That becomes the driving force of your life. In Samatha meditation, dear Ajahn, you let go of feelings, itching, pain, etc. In Vipassana, you contemplate on them. So does one have to reach the jhana stage to do the Vipassana meditation, as it seems totally opposite to one another? In Samatha meditation, it's not you let go of all feelings, you just calm the doing mind, you stop doing things. You let go of the active doing, controlling, making, driving, managing, fault-finding, thinking, that type of mind. You subdue that, so it's very soft and peaceful. With that, the feelings of the body disappear, but not the feelings of the mind. The feelings of the mind get brilliant and powerful. So you're not letting go of all feelings. Because you get bliss at the end. That's what you're left with. And contemplating things, to be able to contemplate something, you need a degree of stillness. This old trick. What am I holding up here? What is this? Anyone know? Yeah, come on, join in the game, come on. What is it? Piece of paper, what else is it? White and black and colour, anything else? Now this is an old trick which you do to teach what insight is. The longer you look, the more you see. And if you said piece of paper and thought that was all that was here, you won't look any deeper. Is this just a piece of paper? Of course it's not. That's just a name. Just a rough description of what this is. If you look longer and longer and longer, you see deeper and deeper and deeper. To get real insight, you have to hold something up and sit long enough to get way beyond what you've already known, what you've been taught, all your concepts, all your perceptions, to start seeing it deeper. That's why you need a still mind to see things deeply. To be able to, you know, see sort of like that blade of grass in the garden. You may come here, you can't contemplate it, your mind isn't still enough or deep enough. After a few days of a retreat, you can look at a blade of grass and you can see it deeply. You can hold it still. You're not distracted. You're awake. You can stay. So real contemplation does require a great degree of stillness and powerful mindfulness. So that's why Samatha Vipassana always go together. There's not two different types of meditation. So it's no, some people say in Samatha meditation you do this, and Vipassana meditation you do something else. That's a lot of baloney. Samatha and Vipassana always go together. Next question. I apologize to anyone I've caused suffering to by talking every day so far on this retreat. There is a confession coming up. Now, what should the punishment be?
Really funny.
Read that. Now, where is Where is your compassion and kindness?
2 day party.
2 day party, 3 day party, okay. Remember, I've talked every day as well. I've said more than any of you. It's just that I'm one of those who are assisting Waninath's main carer, so we have to talk. By the way, if you would really like to develop your practice in generosity and compassion, then speak to Ron and ask how you can help as well to provide care for Waninath. Isn't that kind and compassionate? So remember, just a word, it's just, usually there's some cause or reason for it. When you find out what the reason is, you think, oh, why did I get so angry at that? That was really necessary. And it created some happiness for somebody else. Sure, it disturbed me, but it helped somebody else. So be kind, be compassionate, have a soft heart. And a soft heart, a little word hits it, and it doesn't sort of shatter and get angry. It just softs, somebody, they must have some reason they did that. How should we deal with greed and craving for our favourite foods, as it's best to abstain altogether? Is it necessary to become a vegetarian to be a good Buddhist? Does this include not eating eggs and fish and dairy? Thank you. It's not what goes into your mouth makes you a good Buddhist or bad Buddhist. It's what comes out of it. There are no many vegetarians. They eat pure. They put pure food in, but it's not pure speech comes out. So be careful. Yeah, greed and craving for food. You can have some, you enjoy your food. Remember, there's a very tough monastery, a Heiji monastery. This is where Dogen, that's where, you know, people get hit with sticks on their back if they fall asleep. A very tough monastery, but when I remember seeing this documentary, I haven't visited there, they actually say the food, they make sure the food is delicious. I thought, softies. You know, why are you just eating delicious food there? And then the monk explained, if the food doesn't taste good, saliva is not secreted by the mouth, the other stuff doesn't come out of your glands inside your body, you don't digest it. To prove that, think of your favourite food now. Now think of it, imagine it, smell it. See, already saliva starts to come out, and other stuff comes out as well. If it's delicious, you can digest it much better. So, you know, food has to be enjoyable. But, you know, you understand that if you eat too much, it's going to make you sick. So you actually temper your desires for food, but don't think that you have to make food undelicious. That'll just make you even more sick. So find a little middle way. Food is delicious, will have to be enjoyable, but make sure you use it for the appropriate purposes. Yeah, John, what do you do when you feel depressed, thinking it's too hard? Before you know it, you're in the hand of darkness where it's very hard to come out. Yeah, when you feel depressed, just think of a nice joke or something. Okay, I'm going to tell Ron's joke. Ron told me this joke today. Very nice joke. About the guy who went to a doctor. And the doctor told him, got some very bad news for you. You know, got two diseases. You've got HIV. Oh, no, no, AIDS. And he said, you've also got Alzheimer's disease. And he said, Alzheimer's disease, at least I haven't got AIDS or HIV. That's very funny. It's a very good one, isn't it? Thank you, Ron. You see, and when you tell a joke, you can't get depressed. So there's lots of jokes to come and sort of tell. So I mean, a lot of depression is because you're being a control freak. And now you can't get what you want. Sometimes you're very successful in life, and some you get people like very successful in life. They've got a really nice husband, a nice wife, and they're quite wealthy, they've got a great career. They try meditation. I can't do it. And they get really depressed. Because this is not like life. You don't achieve this through your efforts of will and striving. This is the more subtle. You let go for this. If you're a control freak, meditation gets very hard. But if you let go, it's just so easy to do. you don't judge. So depression comes from being too much of a control freak. And here you learn how to let go and make peace, and depression disappears. It's great not having depression and knowing the way out of it. So how do you get out of depression? Make peace with it. Enjoy it. There's lots of benefits from being depressed. You don't have to go to work on a Monday morning and say, I feel depressed. You say, oh, okay. You can stay in bed. Don't have to get up at 4 o'clock. I feel depressed today. Ah, okay. You can eat whatever you want. People don't mind, you know, because, you know, depression is more important than worrying about your cholesterol and other stuff. So, okay, whatever, what do you want? You get lots of TLC when you're depressed. So there's many advantages in being depressed. So next time you're depressed, milk it for all it's worth. Enjoy it. And of course, as soon as you start enjoying depression, of course, depression goes. Depression is another anger-eating demon. I don't want to be depressed. Get out of here. I'm a nice, bright, you know, bubbly person. This is not the real me. I don't want to be depressed. Get out of here. Anger-eating demon again. So instead just say, depression, welcome. Why have you waited so long to visit me? I've been waiting for you. Come. And of course, you sort of, it's a negative, a reverse psychology. Depression can't stand that sort of attitude. So give it peace, give it kindness. Don't make war with depression. It feeds on war. It's a negative state, and you feed it negativity, it gets worse. Anyway, I often discuss the five precepts with Buddhists. Friends, and it seems that there are very different interpretations of the five precepts. Oh, here we go. It's amazing just how craving can actually change something very clear and to make it sort of allowable to do anything. I have heard Buddhists argue that sex with a prostitute or having casual sex is not sexual misconduct, as both people are consenting. Surely this is not true. These are supposed to be questions about meditation. Gee, I think it actually looks the same handwriting as that fellow. No, it doesn't. Also, to buy meat from the supermarket, is it killing because you have to kill the... Okay. First of all, that, you know, I always thought that even sex with a prostitute would be breaking your five precepts. But, like, great in my life, there was this one case in Thailand, in a village which supported Wat Nanachat, one of the senior people in the village, who was the principal of the local school, he would go and visit a prostitute once a week in Warin. And people already know about him, because he was like a senior person. They would jeer at him, hey, you're going to visit the prostitutes again? He said, yeah. And Ajahn, he was open about it. Ajahn Chah knew it, and we asked him, no, you're breaking the precept. And he told me, no, you went to see Ajahn Chah about this. Because his situation was, you know, he married, he's got this nice wife, but his wife went crazy. And she was unable to do any housework, to you know, offer any sort of sexual services to her husband, to do anything. She was actually bedridden, sort of, demented. And he would look after her, care for her, wash her, cook for her, do everything for her. He was a great man. But he said, I'm a human being, I'm a male, I need sort of some sexual activity. So my wife can't give it to me. And I'm caring for her as much as I can. Therefore he went to the prostitutes once a week. And he talked with Ajahn Chah, and Ajahn said, in that case, I can't say anything wrong. And I look at that and think, my goodness, probably that seems to be okay. If Ajahn Chah says it's okay, it must be okay. Well, isn't there? Sometimes you argue with Ajahn Chah, but in that case, what's wrong with that? So for him, I say he has a wife, but because, you know, she was mentally sick, you know, unable to, you know, even just to get up and do housework, let alone anything else, that was not breaking his five precepts. So those five precepts, you've got to really look at them very deeply to find out exactly what they mean. However, if you've got a partner, you've got a wife or a husband, then, you know, going down to the house of ill repute, as they call it, is breaking your precepts. You've got a wife, you've got a commitment there. And it's also, you know, that I've read in the newspapers in Western countries and even more so in Asian countries, there are some of those girls who are working there aren't working there according to their own free will. You know, they're sometimes sex slaves, I think it's called. And if they're not that, they're sort of doing that business because of some social emotional problems. So it's a very, very dangerous area to get into. You know, are you really sort of supporting people who really have freedom to do, you know, that job? So be careful of that. However, you cannot absolutely say that it's sexual misconduct or that's not sexual misconduct. Has to actually examine it to see whether you are breaking your vows to your partner. What type of partner have you got, and are they sort of able to look after you? Those are sort of questions which you have to ask. So the precepts, they're not so black and white. You have to really look into them more deeply. Any comments on that?
There was a show on SBS last year about men, Australian men, who use prostitutes.
Yeah.
And one of the sections was that exact example of a person who had a wife who was absolutely incapacitated, and this guy would raid his piggy bank every week or two, go down and go to the prostitute, and he'd come back and they interviewed him, and he said, no, I love my wife very much, it's just that she's totally incapacitated and sick and mental, and all that is exactly the same as what you said.
Okay, that's fascinating, yes. Okay, so I mean, don't just think because you don't agree with your wife she's mentally ill and think that. I think that's an excuse. There has to be real mental illness. You know what men are like. Ajahn, since no attention is given to breath in walking meditation, how does it complement the efforts in sitting meditation? Simply because you're focusing attention, you're being still, you're being in the moment. So those strengths of the mind, sometimes you think that, you know, a person plays tennis, but they go to the gym. What's a gym got to do with playing tennis and lifting weights up and down? Because you're strengthening the muscles, which you can then use on the tennis courts. The same when you're walking meditation, you're strengthening the muscles of present moment awareness, strengthening the mental muscle of silence, and strengthening the mental muscle of focusing your attention in one place. So when you actually change the postures to doing sitting meditation, you know, you've got the strength of present moment awareness, the strength of silence, and the strength of being able to focus just on one thing. So that's how it works. I'm going through them quickly now because I'm going over time. Setting the alarm last night, the controller wanted it set for 2 a.m. The doer paused. Crazy questions. Anyway, the controller wanted it for 2 a.m. The doer paused and it's fixing this. Sorry, the doer paused in its fixing up this set to suggest 3 a.m. The body was tired and didn't want to set it at all. The brain wanted a good start to the day and thought 3:30 was reasonable. The knower couldn't care less. Elsewhere, this is called multiple personality disorder. That's a great question. It doesn't need an answer. But whoever wrote that, if you were married to a woman, the woman would be quite welcome to go and visit. Ajahn, did the Buddha ever give punishment to bhikkhus? If so, how? Never once. So the only punishment, the worst things, which they probably once. Channa, oh yeah, channa. But just some of the punishments, so they got like for a monk, say, masturbates. That's a really rotten thing for a monk to do. But the punishment, that's not really a punishment. The Buddha said, okay, for 6 days, you know, the whole sangha in that monastery, you've got to go up to them and say what you've done every day for 6 days. You know, not just your broken rule, I'm masturbated. And the idea is there not to punish but to embarrass you. Actually, you're about to put the thing in, you've done something wrong. So it's not like physical punishment, but it's just like an embarrassment to make it very clear to you you've broken a precept. But there was also this fellow Channa, who was the Buddha's charioteer before he became a monk, and then he was sort of a monk with the Buddha, and he was just so proud and arrogant. So he would listen to the Buddha, but no one else. No one else could tell him anything. And after a while, once the Buddha sort of, actually before the Buddha passed away, he said, one of the things to do to this guy is actually, basically, don't speak to him ever again. Send him to Coventry. So the monks are not allowed even to talk to him. So that's what they did. And again, it was just like an embarrassment thing, not physical punishment. And, you know, he thought, gee, that was actually the Buddha himself said that. And that really sort of hit him very hard, that no one's allowed to talk to him. And he really got his practice together, and he became fully enlightened. And then he came to actually to see Venerable Ananda. You know, he said, now look, you know, I'm enlightened now, I'm a pure monk. And Ananda started talking to him. He said, what about the punishment? He said, as soon as you became enlightened, the punishment was over. So that was, now there's the only real punishments in the monks are allowed to do. Even like naughty novices, there was, you know, you have these little naughty novices, and they're usually little ones, but the one at the end there was a big one, he only got a day. So I will never punish him. He's much bigger than me. But once, you know, one of the monks decided, okay, he had his little novices actually to not allow him any food. When the Buddha heard about it, he said, you can't do that. You know, people have to eat. You can't sort of make him fast. So he said, you know, even those things you can't sort of, you know, punish by not allowing them any food. So there's very little punishments which you can really do. The only thing is maybe sending them away. Stop speaking to them, give them a little, like that penance, you have to tell everybody for 6 days what you did. And also, when that happens, he shouldn't tell you this, but actually, the monk has to sit on the end of the line. So you lose your seniority for those 6 days or that period. So people in Thailand know that. So if they see like a monk, say they see me, always in the top of the line, and suddenly I'm right in the bottom of the line. They know exactly what you've done. There are 13 rules, but that's the main one, you know, which sometimes those monks will break. And I've seen it, it's very, very embarrassing to see this poor monk at the end of the line. And the Thai people, you know, who've been going to this monastery, Wat Nana Chat, for years and years, know exactly what he's done. They said, what are you sitting at the end of the line for, Venerable? What are you doing that for? And they know exactly why. Because they're trying to embarrass him to make sure he doesn't do it again also. Anyway, to get into jhanas or the mental happiness, does one need to give up or cut down the physical pleasures in the worldly life? What advice would you give to someone who has a strong sensual desire? Why do these questions come up at this time? Gee. Anyway, it helps to lessen, restrain the sensual pleasures of life. Because it means you're not so stuck in your body and the body happinesses. But, you know, it's not absolutely essential, although it helps, to have less sensual pleasures. How's the time going? This clock. It's only 9:10. I should be able to finish with these last questions. Please explain about the dance between the knower and the doer. Can one live in that knower all the time? Eventually, do you get rid of the knower as well? Is it like caterpillar becoming a butterfly, transformance of the being? No, the knower and the doer is two parts of the same mind. You can only subdue these in the jhanas. Only in the jhanas does the doer disappear, and in the deeper jhanas, the knower starts to vanish. But after the jhanas, the knower and the doer come back. Even an enlightened person has a knower and a doer. But eventually, once you finish off your existence, the doer and the knower completely vanish at all. And also, the difference between an ordinary person and an enlightened person, the enlightened person knows from their own experience, this doer is not themselves, it's just a process. And the knower is just a process too. So it's still there, but you've sussed out what it really is. You've seen through it. If someone gives you an MP3 file or movie from the internet, is that breaking the second precept? Are you stealing? I don't know the actual rules of copyright, but I know that one of the for stealing, you have to know it's stealing to be stealing. If you get it wrong, you think, oh, it's allowed. If you really think it's allowed because you don't know the law, then it's not called stealing in the precepts. To be stealing, they say you have to think it belongs to someone else, it does belong to someone else, and you take it. So it has to actually belong to someone else, and you think it belongs to someone else, and you take it for yourself. Now, I don't know any of these sorts of things from the internet, whether an MP3 file or a movie, it can be downloaded or can't be downloaded, so I'm incompetent to really say about that. But
license.
Yeah.
All files are okay, because it's, the license covers pre-distribution.
Okay, yeah. But whatever, if you have to be stealing, you have to, no, sincerely, you know you're doing something wrong. And it is something wrong. If you misunderstand, because it's not intentional, you just make a mistake, then it's not called stealing. The Ajahn! There are so many intolerant people in this group. Don't think $320 is a business transaction. Do enjoy your time. Smile, relax, you will get more heart attacks by stressing yourself rather than jumping from the bed early in the morning. That's true. So you get heart attacks not from jumping out of the bed, going zippity-doo-dah, by stressing yourself about all these people who are talking or messing around and stuff like that, and snoring. That's true. Just let them go. Ajahn Brahm, please explain. Does strong psychic power give rise to good meditation? I have a Buddhist friend who says when she sits for meditation, are you interested? When he mentions psychic powers, everyone is interested. I have a Buddhist friend who says when she sits for meditation 2, 3, or 2 times daily, Vipassana, some days she sees what is going to happen to her relatives, accidents, etc. She does not tell them, but says it does happen. She also sees ghosts and devas in houses. Please explain. Thank you. Okay, sometimes that people can develop psychic powers through meditation. Sometimes people have psychic powers before meditation. Sometimes those psychic powers aren't real psychic powers. So really you've got to investigate first of all to see whether that person is actually seeing real things or just imaginary things. And some people who have psychic powers do see imaginary things. They're not real ghosts, because real ghosts are very hard to see. And the real ghosts are usually quite okay. They're not sort of playing around or terribly bad. They're just little beings in a lower state of existence who just need some help, that's all. As I say, most ghosts are soft and cuddly. And people say, ah, no, they're not. But sometimes when you see things which are going to happen in the future, sometimes people say they get these visions of the future, but really if you wrote them all down and honestly collated what you think is going to happen, whether it happened or didn't happen, a lot of times it would just be coincidence things happen. You only remember the premonitions which worked, and those which didn't work somehow you just forget about. So you've got to be very careful with such things. And it's very, very rare you find someone who has got real psychic powers. And if you do, you just keep it to yourself. So it's usually the good meditators get the psychic powers, but you have to have good virtue as well. Like Devadatta, he started getting psychic powers, he started getting deep meditation, but because of his pride, you know, he lost all his psychic powers. And he was the guy who tried to kill the Buddha and take over the Sangha. Just pride and ego got the better of him, and he lost all his psychic powers. So usually, if you lose your virtue, you lose your powers. Oh, long question. Okay, and I did say you only can have one question. You've got two here. So I'm just going to do the first one. Dear Ajahn, observation. Noble silence does not equate with noble unfriendliness. Eye contact, a smile, a nod would be nice. We are, after all, in a retreat, not in solitary confinement, in a concentration camp with the monks as SS officers. This is not Guantanamo Bay. Yesterday, two fellow meditators broke their noble silence to ask me, in the most discreet of circumstances, how I was doing. I was touched. They know I had only started meditating last Saturday. Their concern made my retreat here more memorable. Oh, isn't that nice? So that was noble speech. So if it worked, that's fine. But you don't need to get into conversation, like, how are you? Not just talk about, how are you? This is how I am. And how's the weather today? So anyway, I'll do the second question, because that was a nice first question. My husband experienced jhana when he was in a retreat in a Thai monastery. He explained to me that the feeling was much better than orgasm. He's stealing my line. He told me that had it not been his love for me and our son, he would want to stay in the monastery and be a monk. That is how good meditating can be. Yes, that's how it can be. Last question of the day. Ajahn Brahm, will you be able to prove that you are not enlightened? What do you mean? Because enlightened are not supposed to disclose it. Otherwise they have to prove it every now and then. With metta, what does that mean? Will you be able to prove that you are not enlightened? Because enlightenments are not supposed to disclose it. Or enlightened people, I suppose, are not allowed to disclose it. Otherwise they have to prove it every now and then. I think that's what they mean. That one of the reasons why you're not supposed to tell that you're enlightened is that if you told, people would not believe it. And they'd try and look for you. Look out for you. They'd try and sneak into your room at night to see, you know, if you're really sleeping. If you really are getting up zippity-doo-dah at 4 o'clock in the morning. They put CCTV cameras and other things in there to check out what you really do when people aren't watching. That's actually one of this nuns. It was actually a Korean nun I found out last year, who once said, a very famous saying, he said, if you do become enlightened, never tell anybody. Because if you do tell them, you'll have to spend the rest of your life proving you're enlightened. Which is very, very true, because people are so skeptical. If anyone came along and said they were enlightened, you'd be checking them out with a tooth comb, peering at them, checking out everything they did, and trying to disprove it. Which is why, keep it quiet. If you get any psychic power, don't tell anyone. If you can read somebody's mind, do not tell the CIA. They'll get you to go to Guantanamo Bay and interrogate all his prisoners. They'll get you standing at the security checkpoints in the airport to actually see, you know, who is actually carrying these knives, like Ajahn Jamnian. So, don't let anyone know. Otherwise, you'd just be a freak.
But once you're enlightened, you wouldn't have any pride or arrogance anyway.
You wouldn't, but you'd have a lot of wisdom. So in other words, the whole point of being enlightened is not having freaky powers. This is why the Buddha said that the only psychic power he praises, the only one which monks are supposed to show off, is the psychic power of teaching Buddhism, teaching Dhamma. It's wonderful you call that a power. Because, you know, this is what you get when you actually see the Dhamma, the ability to teach. So he said, that's a psychic power, and keep that one, show that one, because that is useful. All the other stuff, flying through the air, reading people's minds, all that sort of asmatas, is a complete waste of time. So he said, that's the only one you should really praise. He said, all the other ones stink. And he actually made it very clear that in the Vinaya, and this is the word of the Buddha, he made it very, very clear to the monks, showing off your psychic powers is like a prostitute showing off her private parts, just for a couple of coins. And that's actually how he said it, almost literal translation. And so it really sort of made it very clear that the monks should not do that, and the nuns, to anyone. So keep it to yourself. If you go into your room, you can fly about your room and bump your head on the door. But don't do it in here. Okay, so you can all go back now and practice your levitation. Good night, see you tomorrow morning.